If you're a fan of the Resilient Recruiter podcast, I've got exciting news. I'm hosting a special event for recruitment business owners in London on September 17th and 18th, and I'd love you to join us. If you want to achieve your full potential, you need to surround yourself with the right people. At the Recruitment Coach Live Summit, you'll get to meet some of my podcast guests in person, hang out with us, and share ideas. Some of the folks I've interviewed on the show will either be attending or speaking at the summit. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Multiple recruitment business owners have told me that they have ADHD. Imagine finding out in your 40s that you are neurodivergent and that personal journey leading you to become a champion for inclusivity in recruitment.
I was in my early 40s. It became apparent that maybe there were some differences about me. I went to get a diagnosis and I was diagnosed with ADHD. And anyone who knows me will know, look at my desk, that's no surprise. But I was actually also diagnosed with an autistic spectrum disorder. I prefer the word condition, but technically it's a disorder.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby. And today we're joined by Adam Tobias.
The light bulb moment in my life was recognizing that I could do what I love to do, but with purpose. And that supercharged recruitment for me. Once I recognized there was a purpose, which is to make the world a fairer place, to reduce barriers for different kinds of talent, underrepresented talent in the workplace, purpose kind of came alive and it changed everything.
Adam is a co-founder of Inventum Group and has been in the staffing and recruiting industry for over 25 years. They have a team of 20 people based in London and Johannesburg.
One of the things that I've learned, and I learned the painful way, is that ego is not helpful. There were times when we had multiple offices, but it was a lot about ego. It wasn't about profits. It was about saying, hey, I've got, you know, three or four offices, and we've got this number of people, but actually it wasn't necessarily as profitable, you know, and I think there's an ego aspect to that.
Adam's a passionate advocate of equity, diversity, and inclusion. He advises business leaders, HR professionals, and recruitment teams globally about inclusive recruitment.
When we use culture fit, what we're really saying is, are they like everyone else in the team?
Right.
But actually, we want culture add. Are they adding to the culture of the business?
Well, that's a good distinction.
Yeah, and it's a big difference. And so we end up hiring people just like us, and the culture stagnates.
Adam, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'm excited we get to do this in real life.
Yeah, we're recruiters. We like people, right? So
you
it's nice to be in person.
You got it. So I'm fascinated to hear your journey. You've been, I think, 25 years in the recruiting game?
27.
27,
this year.
Okay.
Wow, I know. You're surprised given my youthful looks, right? But yeah.
So that's about the same as me. I started in 1997.
There you go.
And so I'd love to hear how you've built the business. You've got offices in Johannesburg and, of course, London being the head office. So that's a cool story.
Yep.
But we've got some other topics up our sleeve that we were going to delve into. So let's dive in. How did you get into recruiting?
Well, that's an interesting question. I want to take you way back.
Way, way back.
Way, way back. So actually, my mother ran a recruitment business.
Oh, that's cool.
I know, right? So she was a bit of a trailblazer. She, as a woman, starting a recruitment business in 1984, I believe it was. So I've always been around recruitment. I mean, she did say to my brother and I, whatever you do, don't go into recruitment. And I started in recruitment and built a business, as did my brother, who also started a very successful recruitment business, which he subsequently sold. So yeah, we ignored our mother's advice. So I've been in it my whole life. And actually, I started a career in financial services for a brief period of time. But I found myself in recruitment pretty early on in my early 20s. And yeah, I loved it. I love people.
So you knew what you're getting into then, I guess. Had you been in the office, did you really know what you're getting into?
No, I had no idea whatsoever.
Okay.
Right?
Your mom probably made it look easy or...
You know, I think there's been a lot of change, right? But she was very, very good at it. And I've always aspired to be like her.
Yeah.
Because that's a huge inspiration. So I kind of had an inkling, but did I really know? No.
You know, it looks easier from the outside.
It does. It's always been tough.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I think someone said to me, and I, a mindful of cheesy quotes, but they said to me, you know, sales and recruitment sales, it's the worst paid easy work and the best paid hard work.
Right. At the same time.
At the same time, yeah. Right? So if you want to cruise, no. Mm-hmm. If you want to work hard, then you can do really well.
Yeah.
And I think that's as true today as it was when I started in the industry and when I started the business, which is now Inventum Group, which is 20 years old this month.
Oh, so congratulations. Yeah. That's a huge milestone. Wow, 20 years in business.
I know. I mean, and that in itself is an achievement in itself, right?
100%. That is an achievement for sure. So you didn't join your mother's firm.
No. Nope.
You decided to go.
Got another job.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, now my boss then is my business partner now.
Oh, okay.
There's a long journey there, but we don't need to go into all the details. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, look, this is a business about relationships, right?
Right. Yes. And
I'm proud to say some of those clients that we worked with when we started the business 20 years ago, we're still working with today, right? So it is about relationships and being able to find common ground and getting on with people.
Totally.
It's been an up and down journey. Listen, there's been great times and there's been some really hard times. I think if you're in it like yourself, Mark, for a long time, there's upturns and there's downturns. When there's times when we're flavor of the month and there's times when people won't, you know, give us the time of day, right?
Yeah.
I think the challenge is trying to build a level of consistency through those times.
We have talked about this before, the idea that like when things are going great, don't get too excited, right? Don't start believing that you're the greatest thing because life is about to knock you down a couple of notches. But equally, when things are going terrible, then don't beat yourself up too much either, because things will, if you keep going, things will turn around again. And having that even keel, I think, that's why we call the show The Resilient Recruiter, right? Because, you know, you can't be in business for 20 years and not have that. So 20 years in business, what's the sort of overall size shape of the business now?
So we're a relatively small business, about 20 people.
Okay.
Predominantly in our key markets are finance and accounting, really exciting stuff, and digital marketing.
Okay.
And you might think, well, they're very, very different, but there's actually a lot of connection and we work with clients across all parts of our business. We also do have an HR and a legal function as well, on a slightly smaller scale. And I think, you know, look, you talked about resilience. This is all about resilience, you know, not riding the wave, right? Not riding the wave. This too shall pass. You know, I say that's the good stuff and the bad stuff.
Yes.
Now, of course, everyone, when they start a recruitment business, has this, you know, this image that they're going to have hundreds of people, offices all over the world and sell for many, many millions. And look, some people do that and that's great, but that's not the only kind of success. I think actually building a resilient, a robust business with a good brand name, with good values, and being able to, you know, work for myself for 20 years, that's a huge success.
Definitely.
So it's been a great journey.
Okay. What have been the kind of real high points in that 20-year journey?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I think, you know, there's been lots of them. I think, you know, just being, you know, being able to be in charge of my own destiny has been really, really wonderful. Mm-hmm. Learning a lot of lessons. I've made tons of mistakes. We all have, you know, and I've had partners along the way and we've made mistakes.
Yes.
My business partner now, Russell, you know, he's been in the recruitment business even longer than I have. You know, we've made mistakes. We make mistakes, you know, and that's okay. We try and learn from them. But I suppose the high point is working with some really great people. Some of those people have been with us for a really long time.
That's awesome.
I think that really is. That says everything. Yeah. You know, creating an environment where people feel safe and supported.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I'm also quite passionate, as you know, I've talked about this with you, being able to expand our offering to our clients. So we're not just a recruitment business. We actually do. And where I spend most of my time now is actually working with clients, advising them about talent attraction strategy, advising them about inclusion. You know, as you know, I'm very passionate about building inclusive workplaces. So actually being able to add a different, you know, more value to our customers, it's been great.
Awesome. I'd love to hear about that. Before we dive into talking about your service offerings and how you've blended executive search with, you know, talent attraction and inclusion and other value added kind of consulting, you mentioned you've made lots of mistakes. Like, what stands out as one that, you know, if you could go back, you would rewrite?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, right? Because, you know, mistakes are part of our journey. We learn through mistakes, right? Yeah. And so it's easy to say, well, I should. There's been some people I've hired that perhaps we shouldn't, but for them as much as for us, we shouldn't have done. Yeah. We did an academy. So we launched an academy. Yeah.
So for people listening who don't know what that is, essentially what that means is it's like a boot camp for rookie recruiters.
Correct.
So you're hiring a cohort of people with no recruiting experience, but who you think have potential. You put them through the training process and hope that, you know, a proportion of them will stay with you and contribute to the business.
Yeah. And we wrote a training manual, we built a train, having never done any of this before. Yeah. And on the face of it, it seemed like a wonderful idea. Yeah. You know, when the markets are good, it's very hard to find good people.
True.
Everyone's looking for the same people.
So you have to
build your own, yeah, right? Yeah. And you think, well, actually, if I build people up and I train people in the way that we want it to be done properly, mm-hmm. we're going to come up with exactly what you said.
Yeah.
But I was quite naive. We were quite naive at the mm-hmm. time. Listen, there's nothing wrong with being ambitious, but we were a bit over ambitious, I think. We went a bit too deep and we went a bit too big. And just at the time, I don't think all my partners at the time, we had we'd really thought it through properly. We hadn't had the skill set to fully develop and dedicate the time to these rookies.
Yeah.
And it didn't work. You know, we kept a couple, but it cost a huge amount of money.
Wow. Okay. And time.
And time. Mm. And again, so, you know, the impact was really big. So I think if there was one thing that I would say is that, you know, we were all given a chance, weren't we? We were all given a chance, and I'm desperate to do that for people. I think we weren't equipped. We were a bit ambitious. Mm-hmm. It's probably the wrong time. And
if you were going to do an academy again, what would you do differently this time to make it work?
Well, would I do an academy again? I don't know if I would. I think I would be a little bit less bold with size.
How many did you have in this?
We hired like 15 in one go.
Okay, wow. You did go
for
it.
Yeah, we went big.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, yeah. And and it was great. We'd moved into a brand new office. We had this massive space. We had this training room. It was like, great, let's do this.
Yeah.
So if I was going to do it again, I would start it smaller. Yeah. I think, you know, training wasn't embedded in our business in the way that it is now.
Yeah.
And so we kind of did it backwards.
Right. If you get the learning development piece in place first, then you're equipped to develop those new.
And then you can bring them in at a slower pace and recognize that, you know, this is a hard job, especially when you first start. Yeah. I don't know what the numbers are, but it's not a big percentage of people who start in recruitment stay in recruitment beyond 5 years.
Right.
Or even one year. But to get to 5 years, which is really where you're starting to learn your craft.
Yes.
You know, where you're developing long-term relationships where that can see you through the tough times.
Yes.
It's hard. I don't know what the percentages are, but I bet you it's
low.
It's low double digits or single digits, right? Yeah. In percentage terms, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So we were, and perhaps we weren't... maybe methodical enough with the pre-assessment process.
Yeah.
Because a recruiter, we like people, we want them to do well. We'll look at the positives over the negatives, right?
Right.
So that's one, I think that's a standout mistake.
Okay. I think, so our clients that are scaling fast and doing an academy style thing, they're probably taking 4 to 6, right? In one, only if they're really good. Like, they're not kind of making up the numbers. They're like, and maybe if there's only 3, then or whatever, right? But ideally, I think they're aiming for 6. But if they get 3 or 4, then they're still going to, and they might do that a couple of times a year, right? That's the kind of idea. And it's because it's not too many that your leadership team can't spend the time mentoring and so on.
Yeah.
But at the same time, so I do think there's a benefit of hiring more than one person at the same time.
Sure.
Because A, it doesn't take that much more time to train 2 as it takes to train 1. And B, they then have a bit of friendly competition, right? They're starting at the same time. they've got like who's going to be the first to get their deal or whatever, right? So
oh, and we have hired people in twos,
yeah, in
before.
Batches, and
but yeah. Yeah, I think you know, lessons learned. It's very, it's easy in hindsight to say, oh my gosh, what a crazy sure. mistake that was. But you know, we were young. I started the business when I was 28.
Okay, cool.
So
same age I was when I started my.
Well, there you go. Yeah, and yeah. I think you know, I didn't have a family. You know, it's like I. So I suppose I don't regret the person that I was doing that. Do yeah. I regret the decision? Sure, of course. But you know, there were worse mistakes out there. We're still standing,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely, 100%.
So we did enough right.
What do you think? You said we did enough right, and of course that it has to be my next question. Is thinking 80-20, like what were the really key elements to your success?
Oh, longevity, resilience,
yeah,
right, and also being flexible enough. We've had some challenging times over the last, you know, and the recruitment industry is facing a challenging time right now. So over that time, we've been bigger than we are now. We've been smaller than we are now.
Yeah.
You know, we've been 40 people.
Okay.
We've been 10 people.
Yeah.
You know, there's a degree of flex and flow. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think one of the things that I've learned, and I learned the painful way, is that ego is not helpful.
Right. Say more about that.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, there were times when we had multiple offices, but it was a lot about ego. It wasn't about profits. It was about saying, hey, I've got, you know, 3 or 4 offices. And we've got this number of people, but actually it wasn't necessarily as profitable as it, you know, and I think there's an ego aspect to that, you know, hanging on to operations, hanging on to people because of ego and wanting to feel like we're on this path. And I think that's really important. We have to be ambitious, but I think ego is dangerous, right? Having too big an ego. And I've learned that in the hard way, you know, and I'm not too proud to admit that.
That is a key insight right there, is thinking like, it's good to be ambitious, but is this actually profitable, or are we growing and adding headcount and adding offices for the optics of that? Because it looks impressive or...
It sounds great when you're telling a client or a potential, and turnover, as we all know, is, and the turnover can be bolstered by a contractor base anyway in recruitment, right?
Exactly.
Because you get this big turnover number and you think, hey, look at me, I've made it, right? But actually... That's not the bottom line.
No, GP is the main one that we tell our clients to look at.
Yeah, it's the only thing that matters, right? And look, of course, there is a correlation, of course.
Yeah.
But you know, I would say to listeners, if they're people ambitious in starting their own business or have just started, just be careful about size, and you know, the it's important. But you're actually much better off with less brilliant people, you know, less people, but who are really, really skilled, have great relationships, have the right work ethic, have the right values, than having a huge bunch of people that is very unwieldy. And profit comes from having really great foundations, not size.
100%, absolutely. So let's dive into your thing that you're passionate about, which is, in addition to executive search, you have other offerings, consulting clients. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So I found out actually quite late in life that I was neurodivergent. Okay. So interestingly, like most people, like many people rather, I found out through my kids. My kids were diagnosed, and I was like, that's interesting. Mm. I grew up in London. I grew up in a multicultural society. That stuff's really important. Inclusion has always been important, but particularly when I realized that actually there were barriers in the workplace for people just like me and my children, I wanted to do something about it. So, and I became more and more passionate about helping customers to build an inclusive recruitment process. The recruitment process, in my view, is fundamentally, I say broken is too big a word, but it is
flawed.
Yeah, it's deeply flawed, and there are barriers for great talent. And you know, if you think about it, you know, when you do an interview, now I appreciate as recruiters we screen rather than interview, right? But when you do an interview, you sit opposite someone face-to-face or virtually on a screen, you ask them a series of questions, and then you're looking for, yeah, the answers, but you're really looking for a series of cues about that individual, trusting your instincts to make a decision. But that's really old-fashioned. If you think about all the other business processes out there, they've changed hugely. But recruitment has never changed. It's never changed. It's always like, I'll ask you some questions and I'll take a view on you as a person based on what you tell me you can do, right? And I don't think that's the best way of doing it. And I think that actually stops our clients from building building resilient, high-performing businesses that mitigate risk.
So if I can follow up on a couple of things you said there, one being, I think it's easy as recruiters to be overly swayed by how well someone interviews, right? Because of course, we're getting a preview of, if I put this person in front of my client, are they going to get the offer?
Absolutely.
And in order for them to get the offer, there's certain things that we all like are just eye contact, firm handshake. Like, are they able to articulate themselves succinctly and, you know, expand on their accomplishments and so on? There's certain things that if someone can put those things together, they're much more likely to get the offer. But then I'm detecting, although you didn't explicitly say, but why is that not an ideal way to go about building a high performing team?
A couple of things are going on. Mm-hmm. Right? What we tend to do is we end up building teams of people for our clients who are just like everyone else. Yeah. How many times has a client said to you in your past career, hey, Mark, get me another Johnny.
Right.
Get me another Sarah.
Yeah.
Get me another Dave. And why? Because Johnny, Sarah, and Dave were brilliant. They've done great. So we're going to replicate that. But actually what we're doing by doing that is actually creating a situation where our client is filling their entire team with people just like
them. It's very homogenous.
Totally homogenous. Yeah. We open ourselves up to groupthink where we don't, because we're all similar. Mm-hmm. We start to believe our decision making is unanimous. Mm-hmm. We have an overblown sense of our own morality. Mm-hmm. We stereotype others. We don't spot threats and opportunities. So this kind of groupthink situation happens. And I don't think that's in service of customers. Mm-hmm. We know that the best performing teams are actually teams with different experiences, different thinkers, different
Perspectives.
Different perspectives, right? You know, when I used to recruit into when I first started my career, I recruited into investment banking. When a CV landed on my desk from somebody who worked at Goldman Sachs, it doesn't matter what that person said or did. They are going forward.
Of course.
Right? And there were other, and I won't mention any names of organizations, where I was less likely to do that.
Yeah.
So actually, you know, I was, and I think a lot of recruiters focus on a placement. And of course, that's our job. Yeah. But actually, what's the value of recruitment to our, where's the success for recruitment to our customers? Now, for a recruiter, it's the placement, right? Mm-hmm. Make the placement, you get the fee, 3 months passes, no rebate, happy days, move on to the next one. For our customers, it's how long-term that person stays in that organization, the impact they have long-term. Now, the evidence shows when we think about, when we have a different approach to our recruitment, it's not about how well they present. It's not about the handshake and how well we get on, whether we support the same football or soccer team.
Because we like people who are like us, right?
Yeah,
and so
affinity.
It's easier to be in rapport with someone.
Yeah. Yeah, and we do that all the time. So what we're doing is we're building a process that is actually designed to support people like us. Mm-hmm. And so we miss out on different kinds of thinking. We know that when we have different thinkers and with people with different experiences, we build high performance. There's so much research out there and evidence to show that. And yet the recruitment process is fundamentally flawed because it actually flushes out those people and it creates homogeny. So and that's not to say the companies can't be successful like that, but they could be more successful, I believe. Mm-hmm. So actually, how do we help our clients create a recruitment process where difference is not excluded, where actually it's valued? Mm-hmm. And actually, we're fair. So here's an interesting concept. How often do clients, let's say you put three candidates forward and they're going for an interview, will that client interview those three candidates in the same way? Will they ask them the same questions in the same order? Probably not.
Probably not, no.
No. They're going to lead the people like them, mm-hmm. and they're going to maybe make it more difficult for people who aren't like them. Mm. It's just natural. You know, we are prone to our bias. They're very powerful. Mm-hmm. We talked about affinity. Mm-hmm. So what I want to do is build processes that are fair, and actually we get the best talent with potential. And that can feel a bit weird because you may not like that person as much initially.
Right.
But they could be brilliant. They could, long-term, they could really add value long-term.
Yes.
So when the client says to you 5 years down the line, my gosh, that person is really fun, has been brilliant, they've progressed, they've added so much value. I didn't think they were going to be right.
Mm.
How many times in your career when you've placed a candidate, you've called up a client and said, look, I know on paper this person may not look like exactly, but we've got a relationship, trust me.
Yes.
And that person gets the job. You've fundamentally changed that person's life.
Absolutely.
It's amazing. Don't get to do that in many jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's cool. That's one of the best parts, right? Of
the best
what we
bit.
Do. Yeah. So I want to get to consulting, the advice you give sure. clients and how that works. But first, you alluded to your own personal self-awareness.
Yeah,
can you say more about that?
Yeah, of course. So I was in my early 40s mm-hmm. and it became apparent that maybe there were some differences about me.
Mm.
And it was actually somebody very close to me who suggested it. And at first I was like, no way. But then the seed was planted and very quickly I realized, okay, well, look, there may be something in this. And I went to get a diagnosis and I was diagnosed with ADHD. And anyone who knows me will know, just look at my desk. That's no surprise. But I was actually also diagnosed with an autistic spectrum disorder. I prefer mm-hmm. the word condition, but technically it's a yeah. disorder. Which came as a huge shock, but helped actually understand a lot of the ways in which I work. You know, I can get very interested in certain topics, as you can probably tell. I can hyper-focus on a piece of work. I'm not always, and unusually for a recruiter, I'm not always the best in social situations. Mm. Not naturally. I've had to learn a lot of those skills.
Yes.
Everyone assumes recruiters are just these gregarious, big personalities, and many people are.
Yeah.
But not everybody.
For sure.
In fact, some of the best recruiters I've ever worked with or seen in my life are incredibly, you know, they're very organized and structured, but not necessarily gregarious, not necessarily charisma. So it really helped me to understand a lot more about myself. And I recognized that I was a bit different and I was really lucky. I feel very, very blessed that I was able to start my own business and make it succeed. Because to be honest with you, I wasn't the best employee. And I look back now knowing I wasn't the best employee.
And that makes sense. Some of the things add up.
Hugely now.
Yeah.
And it's actually not unusual for a lot of people with neurodivergent conditions to start their own businesses because they build the structures around them that work for them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Don't necessarily fit into I was not great with timekeeping. You know, everyone else is wearing a suit. I'd wear a suit and shirt and then a pair of jeans to work. You know, I was a pretty good recruiter, so I got away with it, right? Yep. But, you know.
So, okay, let me reflect, if I may, just reflect.
Sure.
Because this is resonating strongly for me. You said that you got some feedback from someone who knew you that, hey, have you considered this? And then you got a diagnosis. I'm curious about that process because, first of all, I know that a lot of our listeners and some of our clients definitely are diagnosed with ADHD. So mm-hmm. I think people will resonate with this. But I think I come from quite a neurodivergent family. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned autistic spectrum. I think my dad and his family, like his brothers, my grandfather, but they didn't have this term. Mm-hmm. They were considered eccentric, right? They were quite odd, but they were smart and they got they were in professions where it was kind of fine. Like, mm-hmm. you know, my dad's a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. His dad was a doctor. His brother was a professor. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of get away with being a bit odd, right? And it's almost a stereotype, right? Like the mad professor or whatever. But looking back, I think, and I know there are people who have been diagnosed with autism in my family. Mm-hmm. So I'm now looking at myself. I'm 50, coming up for 52. I'm wondering, maybe some of my behaviors and it is a spectrum, right? So I guess it's a question of where you fall in that spectrum and whether it's materially affecting your life, your relationships and so on. But what was your kind of process of discovery?
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. It is a spectrum. Some people like a label and some people don't want to be defined by a label.
Yeah.
For me, it helped me understand myself. And I think that was why it was important. And you can be absolutely successful and have in recruitment, you know, you're talking about, you know, eccentric or memorable. That's important.
Yeah.
Being memorable in recruitment is, can you do the job? In fact, my mother told me that. Can you do the job and are you memorable? They're the two most important things. And she was absolutely right. So I think, you know, somebody did mention it to me and I was a bit like, okay, that's a bit strange. Hmm. And I felt, I was actually quite defensive at first. Hmm. Looking back now, it is a family trait. Mm-hmm. These are inherited conditions.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, you can actually, and I'm not an expert, so, but you, there is some physiological changes to the brain where you can actually spot very subtle changes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so, and I look, knowing now, I look back at some of my family, I recognize that in my own father, for example, and I see it in my children as well. So for me, it was an opportunity to learn more about myself at a time where I thought there were some questions. I think, I've got this wrong sometimes, so any listener can check this out. But I was told it was Freud, but I've never been able to find this quote. And it's, but I heard this quote and I thought it was great. You know, we pay rent on our anxieties and the rent keeps going up. Hmm. And what that means is as we get older, it's harder and harder to kind of mask some of these traits right. that we learn very, I learn unknowingly how to behave in a way.
Yes.
Like how to behave in a sales environment.
Yeah.
I learned. It didn't come naturally. Mm-hmm. But the cost of doing that goes up and up and up. It's tiring, masking.
Right.
And I was at a point in my life where I was like, okay, there's an opportunity to learn. And I maybe, if I can lean more into me, then maybe that's going to be a good thing. I'm just curious and going through the process. And it's a difficult process. In the UK, it's a really difficult process to get a diagnosis. If you, you know, we have the National Health Service here. It's almost impossible to get a diagnosis.
So did you go private to go through
that? Yeah. And I'm very lucky to be able to do that and afford to do that. And I get that. So that was the, and then I suppose it, I knew ADHD was, I mean, it was really high. I was really likely to, just given what I'd learned. But the autism, I think, actually was a bit of a surprise, maybe because I just hadn't opened my eyes to it. But it was, it's allowed me to be successful in my career. It's actually helped me, I think, because it's allowed me to be interested in certain and really focus in on those topics.
Absolutely. That's cool. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Pleasure.
I think it's probably not talked about enough.
Sure.
And so I think it's valuable. I'm not sure about the label thing as well, but I do think it's valuable to understand yourself better in order to be happier and more successful. Like if the more you know yourself, then the you can work with your strengths and find how to organize your life in a way that's going to support you. Did you decide, if you don't mind me asking, did you decide to take medication or?
So it's interesting. There's no medication for autism. At least I'm not aware of any.
I'm thinking more of the ADHD.
The ADHD. So in the UK, there are two kind of, and I forget the medical, there's about five different medications you can take for ADHD, as I understand it. The two most well-known brand names are Ritalin, which you've probably heard of, and Elvance.
Okay.
And I did actually try Elvance for a while, but it's interestingly, because of autism and ADHD, they can actually blur the sharp edges of each other. Hmm. It's very common to have comorbidity.
Yeah.
So you have more than one condition. That's actually really common with certain neurodivergent conditions. Mm-hmm. A lot of people with autism have ADHD. Yeah. And it's not uncommon. And they can blur the sharp edges a little bit. I do know a lot of people who, and it's funny how you attract people around you who are also neurodivergent. So I know a lot of people who are, and some people really, the medications really, really help them. Mm-hmm. I'm not advocating for or against. Mm-hmm. It didn't necessarily for me. What was most powerful for me was understanding myself and doing research and understand, learning about what works for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I if people want to go down that road, that's absolutely fine. You know, I think it really helps. A lot of people will say that it helps to quieten out the noise, the busy brain. Mm-hmm. And allow you to focus. And if that works for people, then, you know, I'm not here to say that you should or shouldn't.
Okay. Interesting. That's inspiring for me. So thank you for sharing it, because I think, I don't want to make this about me, this is about you, but I've got billions of ideas. I start lots of projects and then my team have to chase after me going, okay, Mark, let's get this one done before, and this one's a good idea, but let's just park that until Q3 because like we still have a lot to do to do this project and have to kind of like manage me in order to keep us going in that direction. But what, so you didn't go the medication route, but what, if any, changes have you made in managing yourself and your work and everything else that have been helpful?
So there's a lot of technology and a lot of systems that you can use. You know, I remind in the, it depends on what part it's, I guess all neurodivergent conditions are social constructs, i.e. they're a name given to a group of behaviors. We say, well, that group of behavior is this, and this group of behaviors is that. Okay, so there's a lot of crossover. So, but for me, things that have worked for me, that I recognize that I manage myself. So if you ever see a notepad near me when I'm working, it is covered in doodles, right? And I say to people, if I'm in a meeting with them, hey, I'm going to doodle, right? And that means I'm listening. Don't think I'm ignoring you, right? Because actually you might think, well, someone sat there in a meeting doodling away. They're not listening to anything I'm saying. I was like, no, I really am. It helps me to concentrate. Okay, that's just a little throwaway thing. I schedule meetings. Don't like to do them for more than an hour unless I have to. Sometimes I'll do a lot of, you know, I present a lot and I do workshops with people and they can be half a day or all day. So I build in little breaks. My, you know, we don't do hot desking. And I certainly don't do hot desking.
Okay.
My desk is my desk. Get your hands off.
Okay. Because, it has to be.
That's that. So for me, recognizing systems and processes, you know, I love people. I love being around people. But I also recognize that I need to, that does deplete my energy. So I need to, so I work from home a good couple of days a week. That's great. And this is the world that we live in now, which is fab. Routine is important for me. You know, time alone is important. Getting out for a walk is important for me. Thinking time is important for me. It's okay to be away from your desk. That is work. If I'm out there thinking, you know, I get distracted very easily. I have noise cancelling headphones sometimes. It's not, again, not being rude. That works for me. So I guess the more you know about yourself, the better you can build your routines. And also being open about it. Like we live in a time now where we, it's okay to talk about what we need. I would have not, I would have felt ashamed if I'd found out in my 20s about this. I probably would have been ashamed and I wouldn't have told anyone. It's, I'm a different person now and the world is more ready for it.
Definitely. I think so many things you were saying about yourself, I could relate to, Adam. And like the thinking time, I love people, but I also, it does drain my battery. And so like my... And because of the job that I do and that you do, it means all day you're engaging with people, like concentrating, empathizing, relating, advising. And then at the end of the day, I'm done. Like, I don't want to talk. And which drives my wife crazy because like she's ready to, like, okay, great. Mark's finished work. So, you know, and I'm like... monosyllabic. Yesterday we were at the Recruitment Agency Expo in London, and I think some people would thrive on that kind of like chaos, but and it was fun, but at the I was absolutely drained at the end of it. And I said to Sanjay, we left a little bit early actually because I was just like, you know, man, I'm tapped out.
And it's knowing that and actually saying that's okay. That's knowing myself. I loved it, I got a lot from it. And now need to, and actually sometimes, you know, what are the processes and systems that can bring me back? Because I don't need hours and hours of alone time. I need a little bit just so I can, how do I structure that in my day? I mean, and some days are busier than others. Today, for example, I've done two workshops and then here.
So it's going to be intense.
And, but it's interesting because I find in a way, and doing this, and it's probably the same for you, is there's a sort of a performance aspect to this, right? To the work that we do. And as a recruiter, there's a performance aspect to it.
For sure.
But especially in the work that I do, there's a, and I find that's very energizing for me when I'm doing it. I don't feel tired when I'm doing it, but the moment it stops, I'm like, wow, okay. And so I have to build in some time if I can, you know?
Interesting. Okay, so let's relate this back to the customer then. How has this evolved into an actual service offering in the inclusion piece and everything?
Well, so we work with, we're a recruitment business. And by the way, everything I said earlier, you know, we still have to identify great talent, make placements to make money. That's how we operate. It's our business. So what I'm not trying to do is put barriers in the way of that, but I'm trying to make the process better. But I recognized that we're actually able, I'm really well placed to be able to advise my customers, our clients, on this, to give them. So initially just started, hey, have you ever thought about this? You know, just giving some advice to those customers who may be interested, having a conversation, like saying, hey, is this something that might be interesting
at
for you?
At what point in the, do you, broach that? Because like, I'm imagining you're making a cold call trying to get a new customer or a visit. You don't have any credit in the relationship bank account yet. Yeah. And they're trying to get you off the phone.
Yeah.
But so when's the timing right for you to say, hey, we're looking at your hiring process and I have some ideas I think could make it better, get you better results?
Well, we do it from the very beginning because Great. Actually we are, everything we do is about being inclusive in terms yeah. of the recruitment process. So it is the differentiator for us. So it's the Got very it. First conversation that we're having with a customer about it. Now, we're not necessarily offering additional services at that point, but we are saying, you know, for example, so we have developed a training program called the Inclusive Recruiter, which is a CPD certified training program. Going through the CPD certification was hard. Mm. I want to make that really clear. I don't really, but for our own team. Mm-hmm. So our own team go through a full day, split into two half days, training program about inclusive recruitment that is certified. Then we've got that. We then take that to our customers and say, would, you know, so it's actually everything that we do. It's the very first start. It's the first thing that a new recruit, doesn't matter how much experience they've got, when they join us, they go through that program.
Awesome. Right? So you've actually packaged it as a differentiator.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's makes sense. It's who we are.
Yeah.
And it's not a sales angle. Now, of course, there's a sales angle to it, but it's, it's who we are because everyone in the business, and it's part of the recruitment process that we have. You know, if people don't care, that's fine, but you're probably not right for us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. You know, but this is important to us. Working with purpose. Mm. That was, I suppose, the light bulb moment in my life was recognizing that I could do what I love to do, but with purpose. And that supercharged recruitment for me. Mm-hmm. Once I recognized there was a purpose, which is to make the world a fairer place, to, you know, to reduce barriers for different kinds of talent, underrepresented talent in the workplace, purpose kind of came alive and it changed everything. So it's the first thing that we'll talk about with our customers. And we talk about it from a place of authenticity. Mm-hmm. I know that's a word that gets bandied around, and it's, but for me, it's really important. Actually, if people don't believe it, you're probably not right for us.
Definitely. And I think the point you're making about authenticity is that when DE&I was trendy, and it's being rolled back in the US as we know, but I think there was a lot of it was performative.
Yep.
Companies were saying the right words, but was there any substance behind it? And so I do think that is important that you are doing it yourself, right? You're applying it to your own business, your own Absolutely. Hiring process, and as you said, that you guys are doing. So you talk about it from the beginning, and then what happens from there?
Well, it depends on the relationship. Is that something, you know, I say to our recruiters, if you want me to jump on a call with your clients and just give some guidance and advice, tell them what we do, because it's not about the words. Mm. It's actually about process.
Yeah.
Inclusive recruitment is about process. It's not about intention. You actually have to do it. There's certain things that you do, and it's a process, a structured process. So that's really important. And that's where the difference between authenticity comes in. Mm-hmm. Because it's not just that, oh yeah, we really care. Okay, well, how? Show me what you're doing. What is it that you do that's different? So it depends, I suppose, on the client and how open they are. And if they're not that interested, okay, it's not going to stop us doing it. Mm-hmm. That's okay. We'll continue to make sure that we're trying to attract underrepresented talent. We have an inclusive process where we attract talent, the way we engage talent, where we assess talent, the way we present talent. None of that's going to change. If that's not something that's really resonating with you, okay, it doesn't preclude you from working with us.
Yeah.
But most people do care, actually, despite what's going on in the world. Yeah. Most people do care because at its heart, it's about fairness, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And I think most people are fair. Most people are decent, especially in the recruitment world, I think.
Yeah.
And honestly, I say that as being around for a long time. And then it might be a conversation. We, for example, run masterclasses. We do these free masterclasses. Mm. And we say to clients, well, come along.
That's cool.
See what you think.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's just something, a bit of a value add, doesn't cost you anything. Actually, we give this away. Mm. This is not a sales angle. We give it away a lot. And obviously, you have to pay for my
time. Is this a virtual?
Virtual.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we did, our last one was a couple of weeks ago. We had 250 signups.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's cool. It's a sizable, and these are, you know, decision makers, HR people, talent acquisition leaders, hiring managers. Mm. You know, it's a great way to showcase our business, but it's also genuine and we're giving something away for free because we believe it's the right thing to do. But then clients will come to us and say, well, help us. What can you do to help us? And we have a number of kind of, as I said, programs and different trainings and advisory and consulting offerings that will help our clients with the aim of making them a better business. I mean, that's what it comes down to. You know, I genuinely think if they adopt these practices, it's going to make them a better, more robust business.
This is really fascinating from a few different angles. One is, of course, the purpose element, which then you said has supercharged your, you know, motivation to do what you do and impact more people. So that's awesome. And working with purpose, like that is the, you know, that is the key, right? To finding the motivation. Motivation is not the right word. The drive, the resilience to keep going through the tough times is because you believe that, you know, there's a purpose behind it. So that's huge. And also people can connect. And you do attract the right people when you're living that purpose. People who are resonating with that are going to want to support you in that purpose. So purpose is a key part. Secondly is it is an additional revenue stream, right? And so that's always good to have some diversification of where you're making fees. And thirdly, it also means that your placements are going to be more successful with those companies and you're having a bigger impact with your clients. So there's actually a better result for the customer. So I can see multiple benefits to this. Yeah. Just so I understand the context, like your core business, is it retained, contingent, contract, permanent? What's the mix?
Yeah, so it's we do have a little bit of retain, but it's in the main contingent.
Okay.
So executive-ish level. We're not a search firm. We're not going to compete with Heidrick & Struggles and very nice, but no, that's not our business.
Okay.
We have a contractor in a business as well within that. You know, so we do, you know, that's important to us. Mm-hmm. But in the main, it's contingent. It's contingent recruitment.
Okay.
And it, I suppose you could say, well, this makes us a bit stickier with our customers.
Yes.
Makes us more memorable, but actually it's a real value add to them. There is another revenue stream, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got to justify my time. And I think there's more value for me doing that than just recruiting. I don't. Mm-hmm. So actually help, but it's all working with all of our recruiters as well to help their customers. And again, it's a, so there's a lot of different aspects to it. So it sort of, it sits across all parts of our business. Yes, it's a revenue stream, but actually that's, I mean, it was originally just about washing its face, right?
Okay. Yeah.
It's really just to support the business. Now it's become more successful over time and that's an added bonus and that's great. For me, purpose is everything and it's about resilience. Purpose makes us resilient.
Right.
You know, I think if you get into recruitment, a lot of us got into recruitment. I certainly did because I thought, oh, I can make some really good money. In fact, money's it's not scalable. I mean, it's scalable. It's not capped in theory. Yes. In theory, you know, no one's saying, well, you can't earn any more money. That's the maximum you can earn. Well, you can earn as much as you can bill.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a great motivator and that's great. You know, in charge of what you're doing and that's great, but there comes a point when you need something more. Now helping to change people's lives as a recruiter, the best call you'll ever make is not from the, well, for me it was always to the candidate, never from the client, right? That was just me. But actually impacting people's lives, well, all of a sudden, hey, it feels good. I want some more of this. And so I think that's really why I've leaned that into. I want to do something positive, you know, and I want to be proud of the work that I do. It's not just about, you know, financial performance. Of course, that's important. I mean, that's great. As much of that as possible, please. But I need something a little bit more. And so for me, this was the door sort of opened up and it seemed to make sense.
So in terms of, you've mentioned, used the word process quite a few times, and that said, it's not about intention, it's about process. Yeah. So what are the barriers that employers are putting in front of underrepresented types of talent, and then how do you help them fix that process?
Yeah, so in the amount of times I've said, well, I would love to have different kinds of candidates, but we don't get enough applications. But we have to go where the candidates are. We have to speak to the candidates in the way they need to be spoken to. So we need to think differently. Mm-hmm. One of the things that always amazes me is that when you get a job description or job spec through from a client and it's got 450 different requirements on it, the more requirements you have on a job description, the less diverse the talent pool is going to be. Right?
Sure.
It's like it's a truism, right?
I read that women are less likely to apply for a job unless they meet like 90% of the criteria. Whereas men, if they match 50%, or I don't remember the exact percentage, but it was, they're thinking, yeah, I could do that. And they'll go forward for it more often than women will.
And I've seen some of these things where I'm always a little bit suspicious of data and numbers, but there's definitely something in that. And for example, and I don't want to get too off topic, but you've got things like gender coding in job descriptions and job adverts. Okay. So if a man writes a job advert or job description, it's got lots of masculine coded words, ambitious, driven, you know, that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
And this is based on a piece of research by the Wharton Business School and the American Psychological Society. So it's not me saying that because it can sound quite patronizing. If a woman writes a job advert, they're more likely to have more feminine coded words, support, that kind of stuff.
So I've got a challenge around that topic.
Yep.
And you've done the research and I haven't, but I had this conversation with my wife recently that, because I had read that if the word enthusiastic is a masculine word and you're going to put women off from applying if you use the word enthusiastic. And I was like, really? Is enthusiastic? So I couldn't.
Sounds patronizing, doesn't it?
I couldn't quite agree. Like the list of words that you should not use in a job ad, I couldn't quite reconcile that. And I said to my wife about enthusiasm. She was like, what? Why? I can be enthusiastic. Why? And she was like, that is a load of rubbish.
Yeah. I suppose on an individual basis, then absolutely. Personally, no, we're talking about scale. We're talking about the data is, the research is based on a huge number of people. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about it is that these are all kind of subjective words.
Yes.
We chuck subjective words into a job advert, right?
Sure.
But when you see a CV that says, I'm a driven, ambitious, da, da, you think, oh, come on.
That's true. But you don't believe it in a candidate.
You don't believe it in a candidate, but you put it in a job advert. I could say, you know what, Mark, I'm a really ambitious person. You could say, well, no, you're not, Adam. I've worked with you for 10 years. You're the least ambitious person I know. It's all subjective, right?
Right.
So that's one thing you can do. So, I mean, that's a small part, but actually it's about engaging with talent. But having requirements on a job description, if we do what we've always done, we'll get what we've always got.
Of course.
Right? Everyone knows that. So a lot of this is actually saying to clients, okay, so you've got 15 different things on there. What do you really, really need? What tends to happen with a job description is what's the first thing a hiring manager does when somebody leaves? They dig out a job description, the last one they had.
Right.
They'll think, well, what was that person doing? I'll just add some more stuff on.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you've got this thing that's no longer fit for purpose. It doesn't match the person who left the business. They were never doing all those things when they started.
Yes.
So we're looking for something, we're diminishing the talent pool. So we continue to look for the stuff that we've already got. Yes. So of course, that is going to, I've got to have all these, but do you? So
that's just good recruitment practice anyway, isn't
it?
Challenge the job description, get as many things off the essential list as possible and put them on the desirable list. And let's make this job easier to fill. Because otherwise you're going to go on a wild goose chase.
You're going to go on an absolute wild goose chase and challenge the job description. And if I told most recruiters here, I'll give you £1 million to find a unicorn trainer, they'll probably go and give it a go, right? But actually, and not the desirable list. So
okay.
For me, I was like, there's no desirable list. You either need it or you don't.
Okay.
So that's a good example about something that we just, but our clients say 95 years experience. Okay, great. So you're just saying to me, if I've got someone who's got 4 years experience, I think it's great. You don't want to see them.
Right.
Oh, no, I do. Okay, what about if they're really good, but they've got 3 years experience? We don't want me to send them? Oh, no, I do.
Right.
So we just established. It's a, you know.
Yep.
So being able to challenge the hiring manager. Now, that was something that was really normal to me when I first started in recruitment, and I see it happening less and less and less.
Mm.
But also helping the hiring manager to understand, is this important? Like, I would be asking questions like, hey, how important is it for you to hire different kind of talent? Mm-hmm. And they might say, it's not really important at all. Mm-hmm. Or they might say, and I say, okay, that's interesting. Why is that? So it's about having a conversation. Okay. Here's why we might be putting barriers. Why we might want to think about thinking about more diversity. Now, that might be about fairness, but it's also, we know that diverse teams outperform non-diverse teams. Mm-hmm. There's a reality. So it's about educating the client as well, getting them to think differently about the talent. And of course, that widens the available talent pool.
Mm-hmm.
But you can think about we talked about advertising, but you can talk about how you interview people.
Mm-hmm.
Having a structured interview process. Mm. It amazes me how few organizations don't have a structured interview process where we ask the same, ask candidates who are coming for the same job, not every job they ever recruit, but for this particular piece of hiring, asking all the candidates the same questions in the same order and then scoring them based on their answer.
Yeah.
That takes away a lot of bias.
Do you know what actually is, I think, should make this easier is virtual interviews where calls are recorded, transcribed, and so on. It's very easy then to compare and see if, especially if two different managers are interviewing the same candidates, like, are we actually looking for the same thing here? And have we done each round of the interview the same way for every candidate? Whereas if people are doing the off doing interviews and then it's harder to really keep tabs on that.
I really like Mark. We got on great. You know, we support the same soccer team. We got on really great. Yeah. I can see him fitting into the team all of a sudden. What are we doing there? We're just building more and more stuff like ourselves. Yeah. If we have, and I like to have two people in a hire, in a recruitment process, okay. as in two interviewers.
In the same interview or?
I would like that. Okay. And I would like them to score the interview independently.
Okay.
So, and if they score them independent, otherwise you might say, hey, you're my boss, Mark. And you say, hey, Adam, what did you think of that candidate? I really like them. What about you? And I'm going to be like, yeah, okay. Yeah, you're my boss. I like them too.
Right.
If we went, scored it separately and then came back and say, hey, what did you get for question number three? Yeah. I gave them a three. What did you give them? Oh, I gave them a two. Let's have a debate. We're having a discussion, a nuanced discussion about that person.
Yeah.
That's much more robust and it's much less likely to be impacted by bias. Mm-hmm. And the evidence shows, this is the key bit, the evidence shows that the person, if they get through a competency matrix, structured matrix, it sounds really boring and it takes away the flair and the art, but the evidence shows the candidates who score the highest are the ones far more likely to have a long-term impact in the job.
Yeah. Makes sense. It's logical.
But we don't it's like it's a flair, an art form. Well, yes, but actually,
Sometimes people say, oh, I just trust my gut, right? And in my experience, the only time you should trust your gut is if you get a bad feeling about something, right? I've found with my own gut, if something's off and like a client is saying the right things, but there's something that's not adding up, dig into that. Mm-hmm. But just because I feel good about something is nothing to go by.
You may have heard of Malcolm Gladwell as well. I think Blink. Yeah. Yep. And he talks about gut. There's definitely something in that. We have most of our nerve endings in our gut. Yep. There's something in intuition. But I think you're absolutely right. You know, we talk a lot about culture fit, don't we? And I hate that.
But that should be about the values. So if we're building, assessing the values into the interview process, because how do you measure culture? Well, it's very nebulous, but values is something more tangible.
We have these values, right? Yeah. So we have companies will have values and they're plastered on the wall and they're buried on the website somewhere. Mm. They mean absolutely nothing to anybody in the business. They don't know what they are. Mm. If we're going to have values, we should be interviewing around. So we've got to talk about behaviors. So what are the behaviors required to be successful in the job? Maybe it's a manager's job. What are the manager behaviors? Great. What are the technical skills? It's an accounting job. So are they qualified? Can they do financial accounting? Can they do variance analysis? Great. Right. Our values are things like, you know, teamwork or so how are we actually judging those? Mm-hmm. Are we asking questions? And I'm absolutely in agreement with you. We can ask questions about values and we can score questions about values. So that's where. But when we use culture fit, what we're really saying is, are they like everyone else in the team?
Right.
But actually, we want culture add. Are they adding to the culture of the business?
Well, that's a good distinction.
Yeah, and it's a big difference because we fall into the trap of culture fit. And so we end up hiring people just like us. And the culture stagnates. Mm-hmm. So you're right. Values are hugely important. If you're going to say, and most recruitment companies will have a set of values, and what do they actually mean? Values are basically a guide for behaviors.
Yes.
That's what they're about. Mm-hmm. They should be, I don't know what to do in this situation. I lean on the values. The values help guide my decision making and my behaviors.
Yeah.
It's how we behave around here.
Yeah. Definitely.
And I think that's really important. And then we don't spend enough time thinking about, and you can add values into work and you can score values.
Yeah. So we've talked about the job description. We've talked about, you know, the interview process. Mm-hmm. Are there any other things that you help clients to put in place?
Yeah. So candidate experience is really important.
Okay.
Right. You know, we spend a lot of time and money attracting people to a brand and to a business. And it's very simple. When you give candidates a great experience, and you know, think about the silver medalists, the bronze medalists.
Yeah.
You spend a lot of time and money on those people, bringing them in. They're not quite right. Maybe they're not right yet.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to lose them. If we give them a terrible experience, guess what? We've lost them.
For sure.
Forever.
Yeah.
And if we sell products as a company, mm-hmm. they're not going to buy our products, for example.
Right.
People have bad experience. They'll share about that experience with others. It's really negative. When you have mm-hmm. a good experience, you engage with a company, you might consider reapplying for that job mm-hmm. in the future. You may encourage others to apply. If you're from an underrepresented community, mm-hmm. who are you sharing that positive experience with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other people in your
circle.
In
your community, yeah.
Yeah.
So actually, it's really valuable, giving candidates a great experience. And so I saw a stat, and again, I may be misquoted here, but it was something like 75%+ of people who apply for a job online never receive any feedback whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Do you know what? Now, this is a... Do you know what? No, let's not even go into that segue of how to deal with the... hundreds of applications sure. you get through LinkedIn Jobs or whatever.
It's a different conversation.
But I'm really excited by the purpose that you've created for your work, Adam. And I think it's brilliant what you're doing and how you've grown this business 20 people strong. What's the vision going forward?
Well, look, you know, we've navigated COVID.
Yeah.
We've navigated a very tough recruitment market, let's be honest, right? You know, I've been been in the industry for 27 years. I've seen mm-hmm. downturns, of course, mm-hmm. but this is probably the longest downturn I've seen in terms mm-hmm. of not so much the depth, but the length,
okay.
right? You know, I remember the global financial crash 2008, 2009. It was a very steep drop off, but it was bounced back pretty quickly, actually. Okay. I don't think I've seen a market like this. I was speaking to a client.
Just the stagnation, the
slowness, the challenge. And so, of course, growth is absolute. We've been bigger in the past. We'll be bigger again. And we've got to, but we've got to be prudent and we've got to protect the people we've got. And we have been successful during this period.
That's
so I'm very proud of that. That is, we talk about resilience. That's resilience. Mm-hmm. So longer term, we want to continue to grow and develop in the right way. Mm-hmm. We want to continue to, we don't want necessarily new markets, but who knows?
Mm-hmm.
But what we do want to do is continue our approach to inclusive recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
We want to help our clients understand this is not a political discussion. This is about fairness, but it's also about mitigating risk. It's about driving high performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care what motivates people, if I'm honest with you, if it's ethics, if it's mitigating risk, if it's high performance, the likelihood is one of those things are going to really motivate you.
Yeah.
So we're going to carry on. We're going to continue to offer additional services. Our consulting business is going to continue to grow and work with more clients. We've worked with some incredible businesses, lots of global corporations, FTSE 100 companies.
Mm-hmm.
So more of that, but also helping the small organizations as well. So more of the same.
Adam, you mentioned that you guys have done well in the, you know, through this very challenging market. What, if there was one thing that you would put that down to, what would it be?
I guess knowing who we are.
Okay.
Yeah, really knowing who we are, not dropping what makes us special.
Mm.
You know, we've had to scrap. Listen, let's be honest. You've got to scrap. You've got to know, you know, it's important not to scattergun. Mm-hmm. Right. And to try, but you've got to be able to, we're lucky, we're small enough to pivot
mm-hmm.
and move where, and we've looked at new markets in terms of international markets. That's mm-hmm. been really, really helpful for us. So you've got to be able to scrap and get mm-hmm. stuck in. You've got to work hard. I mean, that's the truth of it. There's no, it's just a bit of a grind and not be frightened to the grind. But I think staying, and this might sound a bit, but, you know, staying true to who we are.
Yeah.
It's important. And actually that's going to see us through. I believe.
100%. Adam, my takeaway is I'm going to go and get assessed for ADHD I'll let you know what comes out of that. So, but that was brilliant. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And I'm pleased I've encouraged you to do what you feel is right for you. Mm. And if anyone listening wants to reach out and talk about this, I'm really happy to do that. But listen, that's great. Thank you so much for having me, letting me chat to you about the things that I'm passionate about and I've got purpose for. It's been a real privilege and a pleasure. Thank you.
That was fun. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business.
And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button and I'll see you next time.